Today we're going to spend some time, as I was thinking and praying about this, I just wanted to spend some time in the first chapter of a New Testament book in the Bible called James. And it's on a subject that I think is going to be very timely for all of us. James takes the first part of his letter in the New Testament to talk about how do you have faith in the face of trials? How do you have faith and maintain a vibrant faith during turbulent times when it's so tested and so difficult? And I just thought, what a great thing to spend some time walking through. So I just want to walk through it, kind of let it teach itself, and hopefully it'll be an encouragement to you. So let me just begin reading the letter of James. This letter is from James. Greetings. Dear brothers and sisters, when troubles come your way, consider it an opportunity for great joy. For you know that when your faith is tested, your endurance has a chance to grow. So let it grow. For when your endurance is fully developed, you will be perfect and complete, needing nothing. What's the biggest issue facing anybody in life at any time? I mean, it's always going to be the same. It's trouble. It's tough times. It's difficulties. You're out of work. You're in a challenging marriage. The tests from the hospital came back positive. You're in a shelter in place order because of a virus. Life is real and comes at you hard and fast. So how do you respond to that? Well, most of the time, we just get mad, or we get bitter, or we play the victim card, or the blame game. And James starts off his letter by giving a radically different response. He says, consider it an opportunity for joy. Now, before you think he's nuts, he's talking about joy itself. Don't misread him here. He's not saying that it's the same as it is a joyful thing that is happening to you. Troubles are troubles. He's not saying put on a plastic smile and act like everything's fine. He's not saying that you should be happy about any of it. In fact, don't confuse happiness with joy, because he's not talking about happiness. Happiness is based on circumstances. Happiness is driven by emotion. No, none of us should be happy about anything that's happening right now in our world or to our lives or to our families. But joy is deeper. It's based on how you think about something, not how you feel. James says you really can have joy when the challenges come. And he tells us why. It's because of what they allow to happen, what can happen through them in the end. Well, let's keep listening to him. For you know that when your faith is tested, your endurance has a chance to grow. So let it grow. For when your endurance is fully developed, you will be perfect and complete, needing nothing. Now, let's stop there. We can talk about faith all day long. James jumps in and says, let's talk about real faith, deep faith, a growing faith, the kind that takes challenges to be produced. Because when you face a challenge, when you face a trial, a difficulty, you've got a choice. You can endure or you can quit. If you endure, you grow. You mature, you become something bigger, better, deeper, brighter, stronger than you were. You don't break, it's like you break out, and that's the joy. James says that you become perfect, not in the sense of perfection, but in the sense of becoming complete, who you are made to be in Christ. But that only comes with the trial, with the challenge. So very much like the way steel is forged, it's through the fire, it's the heat that makes it strong. So the joy comes from what God can accomplish in your life through your trial. In biology, they call this the adversity principle. They've discovered that habitual, ongoing well-being isn't good for a species, and existence without challenge isn't even healthy. For example, you see it in the flabby animals at the zoo that have their food delivered to them every day. You see it in rainforest trees because water is everywhere. They don't have to extend their root system very deep, just a few feet below the surface, which is why the slightest windstorm can knock it down. But a tree that is planted in dry land has to send its roots down 30 feet or more in search of water, and not even a gale force wind can knock those trees down. It's no different with our life. Our pain is often what has developed us and strengthened us and allowed us the ability to grow. You tell me what has wounded you, challenged you, and I'll tell you what has made you and formed you to who you are today. If you let it in a positive way, if we let it forge an enduring spirit, Trials create a moment to either develop perseverance or to just end up on the sidelines of life. A life in Christ that means something that is real and isn't just spiritual lip service is one that is chosen again and again to persevere. I'll never forget something that became kind of a metaphor for me on a whole host of levels that I caught on TV one summer. It was a one-hour program on the Hawaiian Open Ironman Triathlon. And if you aren't familiar with that event, it is the premier triathlon competition in the world, and it deserves its name. It involves a swim in the open ocean of over 2 miles, followed by over 100 miles of biking, ending with a full marathon run, which, as many of you know, is just over 26 miles. What grabbed me, though, wasn't the competition itself. It was the stories of the people involved, their strength of will, their fight to the finish. And one of the people that stood out to me the most was a woman named Lynn Brooks. She was competing, and this alone boggled my mind, in her 19th Ironman. And she talked about how she got on that run. And she told a story that I think was about her first Ironman competition, or one of the early ones on in her life. And during the marathon leg of the competition, she left the race and she entered an aid tent by the side of the road. And her body was aching and her emotions were drained, and the desire to stop, to just end it all there, she said was overpowering. When she entered the tent, she looked over, and sitting on a bench off to the side, she said, was a man who had also been competing. And now he was just resting, he was relaxing, his shoes were off, and he was drinking an ice-cold beer. And as if reading her thoughts, he said, "All you got to do is drop out of the race like me." And suddenly she said she realized who he was, that for her, he was the devil. And she immediately left the tent and re-entered the race. And reflecting on that moment, filled her eyes with tears. She said, "It was the hardest and most glorious day of my life." Okay, that's what James is talking about. How trials bring your faith to the surface for testing and development in a way nothing else can. Because in a trial, you will either turn to God or you'll turn away from God. And if you turn to him, then your faith goes higher up and deeper in. And it'll be the hardest but most glorious day of your life. So let's net this one out. First comes a challenge, then comes some kind of trial, then comes the opportunity to endure. So let's just kind of get this down. Trial, and then you have that choice to endure. And then if you make that endurance, you will be made complete. That's the way this works. But getting that done, that is a tall order. So can we do that on our own even? And the answer is no. And here's where James gives us some spiritual street smarts. Let me just read them. "If you need wisdom, ask our generous God and he'll give it to you. He will not rebuke you for asking. But when you ask him, be sure that your faith is in God alone. Don't waver, for a person with divided loyalty is as unsettled as a wave of the sea that is blown and tossed by the wind. Such people should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Their loyalty is divided between God and the world, and they are unstable in everything they do." Okay, if you need help, if you don't know what you're doing, James says, if you don't see how you can hang on and see something through, God stands ready. And God will meet any effort to endure for his sake with absolute, utter, complete generosity. It's legal to ask him for help. You're supposed to ask for help, and that help will come at the point of your most strategic need. Notice how James puts it. Ask our generous God, meaning the giving God, the one eager to supply what you need. And then he says, who is also the one who won't rebuke you for needing it. It's not like God is going to say, "You need me to help you again? You know, what's wrong with you?" No. God wants us to come to him in just this way, with just these kinds of needs. He is the giving God. So you can and you should go to God with your confusion and your hurt and your anxiety and your weakness, your sense of not knowing which way is up. You can be real with God. You can be authentic with God. You can be small with God and weak with God. And God will give you the power you need, whatever it is that you need, to endure. And notice what kind of help James says, that of all the things we could ask for, there's one to be sure to ask God for. And this may not be the first thing that enters a lot of people's mind when they're in a trial or a tribulation or difficult times or challenges. But he says, ask for wisdom. Wisdom. The wisdom to know how he wants you to handle what you're going through. Wisdom to know how to persevere, how to endure. He'll help you make decisions, navigate the waters, know what to do, what not to do. He'll give you what you most need. If you think about it, if you're in the midst of a challenge, a trial, difficult times, what greater thing could you ask for than wisdom? What greater thing could you ask for? And if you receive God's wisdom, and if you ask him, he will give it to you, then you'll know how to get through whatever it is you're going through. The endurance is won or lost on whether or not you ask for this and then follow it. Particularly because God's wisdom may not be your natural wisdom. In other words, when you kind of think things through and you make T-charts and pros and cons and should I do this, should I not do that, you're applying all of your full rational faculties and all of your natural wisdom. What God is saying to pray for, what James is saying to pray for, is supernatural wisdom. God's wisdom, the wisdom that knows so much more about things than you could possibly know and knows things years down the road that you couldn't possibly know. You may not want to obey when he tells you to. You may not want to stay faithful or be patient or follow through when he tells you to. You may not know what is the most wise thing to do. So ask God for it. So let's see if we can play with this a little bit. When you have trial and you are called to endure, let's say that there's a fourth thing in here, which is that you pray for wisdom. And this is kind of the whole flow of how you can be made complete and how you can see that through in terms of whatever the challenge is that you're facing. But that's not all. James isn't finished with us. For this to work takes something. You can't do it in some half-hearted, limp-wristed, you know, one foot in, one foot out, last resort, tacked on idea at the end kind of way. You've got to come to God as God. You have to come to him as plan A, not just one of many options that you're testing out. The word picture James gives is a really important one. He says, don't be like this wave just tossed on the sea. You know, not a wave crashing on the beach, but a wave out on the open ocean. No anchor, on the surface, just being blown here and there and wherever. You can't do God that way. You can't be going to God one day and then abandoning God the next, and when that doesn't work, you go back and try God again. You can't be looking to God one minute and then looking somewhere else the next. You've got to decide. You've got a purpose in your heart. Either you are going to get through this with God or not. You've got a purpose in your heart, whether you think he can get you through this or not. Either you're going to look to God and God alone for the perseverance and the wisdom you need or not. Now, in the context of that relationship, you can yell at God, cry to him, shake your fist at him, bury your head on his shoulder and cry till you don't think you have another tear left in your body. But it's all to him. And it's with him and in the context of your relationship with him, because he is your God. And you have absolute confidence in his character. You've settled. You have determined that there is nowhere else to turn and nowhere else you would want to turn. Your pursuit of endurance is within the context of your relationship with God, which is why, interestingly, the word that James used in the original Greek that we translate into the English word divided literally means two souls. You know, two spiritual allegiances, meaning your basic faith and allegiance is not settled. And when he talks about it being unsettled, that means it's restless, fickle, not committed in one camp or another. You've never centered your life on God. You've never centered it fully. And when you approach God with that disposition, James says, you're not approaching God as God. And those people, he says, and this is difficult to hear, but James writes very bluntly, he said, if that's where you're at, don't expect to receive what God can give. Don't expect to receive that because you don't have a relationship with God that deserves it. You're not really coming to him as God. You're not really coming to anyone or anything. Your inner world is just so unstable and unanchored. And this is a challenge, I think, for a lot of people right now. And I don't want to pull the punch, particularly in the midst of what we're all going through. You've been hit hard. Everything that's been happening, and it's just brought you to one knee. You've turned to everyone you can and everything you can to get through it. It's not working. You've got one knee down. Can I make a suggestion? Put the other one down. Put the other one down too. Take your challenge, your trouble, your trial to the only one who can help you through it and make you into something incredible in the process. Ask God to meet you in the midst of what it is that you're going through. Now, what James writes next may seem like he's switching gears, but he's not. Let me read it. Believers who are poor have something to boast about, for God has honored them. And those who are rich should boast that God has humbled them. They will fade away like a little flower in the field. The hot sun rises and the grass withers and the little flower droops and falls and its beauty fades away. In the same way, the rich will fade away with all of their achievements. Now, what is up with that? It's actually very simple. James knows that in bringing everything up that we've been talking about, there are some people who will still see those going through tough times as somehow being punished, or maybe that they don't have a blessed life, and that there might also be those living without difficulty as seeing themselves as somehow favored by God and living the better life, instead of the deeper truth that James wants to bring to bear, that those who face the toughest times are actually being given the opportunity of the most life change and creating the only thing that really will survive this world, which is depth of character and tighter commitment to God and an enlarged spiritual life. Wealth will not survive. Money will not survive. A house will not survive. A boat, land, clothes, jewelry, phone. None of it makes it out of this world. Only your soul. Only your character. Only your spirit. So don't get confused about what's going on in this world. God is in the soul-making business. And that's the only business that ultimately matters. So don't envy the rich. Envy the poor, James says. Don't envy the ones free of trouble. Instead, look at the ones facing the dark night of the soul, hanging on to God with all that they have, praying that they would see it through and become who God is calling them to be. Look at those people, and they are the ones that in a way that's so counterintuitive to our thinking, have the most opportunity of being blessed as a result. I had an eye-opening experience with this when I was very, very new in my relationship with Christ. And I had a chance to meet a woman and hear her story, and it was startling to me. Her name was Helen Rosevere. I was in my 20s. She was in her 60s at the time. Helen had been a missionary in the First Republic of the Congo during the Simba uprising of the 60s, which before it ended led to the deaths of over 100,000 people. In the midst of that conflict, while she was trying to bring the message of Christ, she was savagely attacked, sexually assaulted, and beaten. After her attack, she was taken to guerrilla headquarters. And she told a group of us listening to her story that she never thought, "Why me, God?" For some reason, all she could think about was, "What do you want me to do now, God?" In the face of this terrible evil, she soon received a sense of God's leading. She was to go back to those who had attacked her and begin to care for them. Go back as a missionary. So she did. She brought them medical help. She brought food. She decided to love them in order to forgive them. And they could not believe that someone who had been so savagely treated at their hands would react in such a way. And as a result, one by one, they began to listen to her tell about her God. And one by one by one, they gave their lives to Christ. Years later, looking back on that season of her life, she told us that, she says, "I know this sounds really strange, you know, but I'll just tell you how I feel about it spiritually now. I feel like God trusted me with that. He trusted me. They meant it for evil, but God used it for good. It wasn't good, but God used it for good. And he trusted me with what happened and how I would respond and what I would do. He trusted her to endure. And that endurance made a difference, a huge difference. And because of that, she now stands in line for the greatest honor of all. And it's in the words that James adds next. God blesses those who patiently endure testing and temptation. Afterward, they will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. Folks, don't ever forget that this life is one great big test for the life to come. It's one big exam that you don't want to fail. In the end, if we endure, we'll receive the only crown that matters, the only award, the only honor that counts. The phrase used here by James for crown of life was the kind of laurel wreath an athlete would be given for winning a race or making it through a competition. And that's what life is. It's your Iron Man. Well, James adds one more thought, one to make sure that we don't get any of this out of whack or theologically distorted. When you go through the dark times, when you're pursuing endurance, you're going to be tempted not to endure. We know that. You're going to be tempted to do a lot of even non-God, anti-God, embarrassing to God, or even to heck with God kinds of things. You're going to want to give up and give in to handling it in some other way than trust and faith in God. Even if it's just ethical shortcuts or just what, there's a thousand ways that we can be seduced in the midst of difficult times, away from what you know God has called you to do and to be. You're going to want to see your trial almost as an excuse to do it, an excuse to deviate, an excuse to sin, an excuse to give up, that the test was too hard. God shouldn't have sent this kind of test. You can't be faulted for failing in this kind of context. If you give in to that, you're going to look for somebody to blame because you're not going to want to blame yourself. And most likely candidate is that you're going to blame God. James says, okay, let's get that out on the table and let's make sure we see it for what it is. So he writes these words. Remember, when you are being tempted, do not say, God is tempting me. God is never tempted to do wrong. He never tempts anyone else. Temptation comes from our own desires, which entice us and drag us away. These desires give birth to sinful actions, and when sin is allowed to go, it gives birth to death. Here James is wanting us to see that just like the choice to endure is ours, the choice to ask for wisdom is ours, the choice to screw up and sin and abandon the way of God, that is ours too. No matter what our context is, there's no excuse for it. God is not tempting us to do anything. God may allow things into our life that challenge our faith, but he never tempts us to sin. Just don't confuse that. Whatever we do against God is our deal. And James nets this out as clearly as possible. He says it begins with our desires. And when those desires are left unchecked, it leads to sin, a willful act, a conscious choice. And then if that's not owned, confessed, and turned from, it leads to spiritual death. Which is why endurance is not just about challenges. It's not just about tough times or troubles. It's about resisting the kinds of temptations that can creep in when we're facing those challenges. Again, you may fall flat on your face. You may fail in the midst of trying to endure, but don't blame it on God. Own it yourself. And then ask God to forgive you and help you get back in the race. Endurance is a process. Eugene Peterson once wrote that it's a long obedience in the same direction. You may stumble, you may fall, but you pick yourself back up and you keep going. Well, if you're a sports junkie like I am, you know that ESPN is flooding its channels with games from the past right now since there's not any live events. The other day, I caught a replay of the Chicago Bulls playing the Portland Trail Blazers in the 1992 NBA Finals. It was the opening game. Michael Jordan was in his prime. He set, in fact, in that game, an NBA record by scoring 35 points in the first half alone. But as I was watching the game, memorable as it was, I couldn't help but think about something else that I knew, that I remembered, happened that same sports year. It was also in 1992. It was during the 1992 Olympics in Barcelona. And what happened was a 26-year-old Briton named Derek Redmond was competing in the 400-meter race, and he was favored to win. He was expected to get the gold. And halfway through the semifinal heat, he collapsed on the track with a torn hamstring. And I just can't even imagine what that would have been like. I mean, years of training since he was a boy for that one moment. And it was gone in an instant. Well, medical attendants began to race to his side, bringing a stretcher to carry him away. But instead, he struggled to his feet and crying in pain and probably in disappointment, he began to hop and limp his way down the track in a vain effort to finish the race. His father was on the sidelines, a father who loved him dearly and had been with him every step of the way. And he came rushing out to him and grabbed him. And Derek said later that what his father said to him was, "You don't have to do this." Or the father said to the son, "You don't have to do this." And the father said that Derek said in reply, "Yes, I do." And then his father said, "Well, then we're going to finish this together." And they did. His father wrapped his son Derek's arm around his shoulders and helped him hobble to the finish line, fighting off security men, waving them off, because he wanted to help his son endure to the end. And the son's head sometimes was buried in his father's shoulders. They just stayed in Derek's lane to the very end. You know, today, after all those years, I don't think about who won that race. I couldn't even tell you their name. I don't think about that medal or that award, but I know who Derek Redmond is. The one who fell but endured with the help of his father. That's the life we're called to live. A life that meets trial with the knowledge that it can be met with endurance and with the help of a father who is so eager to help us. If we'll just ask and make him the center of our life, and he'll get us across the finish line. No matter what may be happening in our world, whatever what may be happening in our life, he'll get us across that line. And he comes to us not because of our strength. He comes to us because of our need and whether we want to get back up and get back in the race. Well, let me pray for all of us. Father, thank you so much, so much that you're that kind of God. You're just that good, and you love us just that much, and you're just that generous. And when we come to you with the spirit of you being our God and at a point of great need, asking for wisdom and help and just can pour everything out to you, you are so eager to hear every word, wrap your arm around us, pick us up in whatever way we need, and help us endure. I know that there's a lot of people right now that need to come to you that way and pray to you that way. I need to come to you and pray to you that way. And so I just pray that this was a reminder of the freedom we have to do that and the importance of doing that, that we're not going through this alone. You are a God for the weak, a God for the difficult, a God for the troubled times. We're going to turn to you that way. And I pray all of this in the name of Jesus. Amen.